Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the common law right after this. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it is regulated by the Welfare Department, Department of Family Services, and Family Court. And the best part about all of this is that you have no input whatsoever into or say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or restraining orders, but you get to pay for all of it, and if you fail to pay, you go to jail. Now, marriage is the most important and expensive contract that you can engage in. It's more binding, and it's more costly than your military enlistment or your 30-year home mortgage. And you probably know a whole lot less about it than you do your military obligation or your house payments. 67% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce, but whether you're a husband or wife, you do have rights, privileges, and immunities to advance, to protect, or to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. And that's why you should know and understand the terms and conditions of your marriage contract before you marry. And you should write that contract instead of letting the state write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my general law CD package and then let me share some vital information with you about the law and this marriage contract. You can call direct to ask for yours. It's 417-273-4967. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can go online, get on the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or just call direct, 417-273-4967. Some years ago, a man came into my office, a fellow by the name of Ted, and he said, "We need to get more into the common law." "Common law," I said. "Well, what is the common law, Ted?" I asked, and he didn't know. He simply didn't know. He kind of stuttered and stammered around a little bit, and he said, "Well, it's, you know, like a, well, you know." And I said, "No, Ted, I don't know what the common law is. I hear the term from time to time, but I don't know that it's relevant in the 20th century. I don't know that it's relative or relevant to our courts today. And if it is, how does it work?" I said, "Ted, go out and get a 5-gallon bucket of common law. Bring it in here, set it on my desk, and let you and I get into it up to our armpits. And let's find out what it is and how it works." Well, that was 20 years ago or more, and I still haven't got that 5-gallon bucket of common law to stick in my hands and kind of swirl it around a little bit. I'm still waiting. But in the meantime, I did a little research on the common law to find out what it is. So one of the first things I did, I happened to be talking to an old lawyer buddy of mine, an old Mormon country lawyer from Cuna, Idaho. And I said, "Ben, what do you know about the common law and how does it work in our courts today and what relevance does it have?" And he mused for a moment and he said, "Well, it seems to me in law school we spend about one semester on the common law. And," he said, "I can't really remember very much about it. It doesn't have any relevance to what we do in court today because we practice the Roman civil law today." Roman civil law. If you take a look at our capital in Washington, D.C., and if you'll go to your state capital, that's called Roman architecture. If you'll look at the word Senate, it comes from the old Roman Senate. a legislative body from ancient Rome. And that Senate enacts our laws today. Now, of course, we have a House of Representatives, and we use terms like legislators and senators and representatives, and we've got names, city councilmen and mayors, you know, that make our laws for us. But this process that we use today doesn't have very much in common with the common law. Common law. That common law comes from commoner. It's the law of the commoners. But what commoners is it the law of? Is it the commoners of Russia, the serfs of the Middle Ages? Where does this term come from? How ancient is it? What's it all about anyway? There are people in America practicing common law courts, and they talk a lot in patriot circles about the common law and how the common law has been lost or abolished, or how our government has usurped our common law rights in one thing and another. Name five common law rights that you think that you possess, have, or own. You know, when you ask people questions like that, they just kind of stagger around. They look at you like with a blank stare like, I don't know. The subject of law is all pervasive. It colors everything that you do from the time you get up in the morning until you go to bed at night. It's an invisible something, but we're all cognizant of it. From the time that you go out and get in your car and you check in your purse to see if you've got your driver's license and proof of insurance. That's an unconscious act on your part, but the law makes you do that, doesn't it? You buckle your seatbelt and you drive out on the road and drive down the right side of the road here in the United States. And that's because the law requires that. You stop at stop signs. You pull over when an ambulance or a fire engine is coming down the street, and you stop and let him go by. You send your children to public school, not because you have any real desire to send your child to school, but the law requires it. You don't think about that every day when you make your child's lunch and pack him off to school, but the reality of it is you're sending your child to school because the law requires it. And you're cognizant of the fact that if you whip your kid too hard, that the social services lady will be out to talk to you about it. And when you go to the bank, you make your deposit, you write a check. That check that you write is regulated by law. And if you write a check for more money than you have in your account, the law may come into play and put you in jail. It's against the law to kite checks, against the law to write checks on insufficient funds. These are rules that we play the game of life by. When you park your car, you got to put a quarter in the meter, or you run the risk of getting a ticket. And if you don't pay the ticket, you run the risk of further consequences. Your car may be impounded, it may be taken. All of these deal with law, but how much of this has to do with the common law, and how much of it has to do with Roman civil law, and is there some other form of law? How many forms of law are there? Now, did you ever stop and ask the question? The Chinese have laws. The Japanese have laws. The Germans. You know, you stop and think about it. Every country in the world has laws, and they have legislative bodies that create and make those laws. Sometimes they even repeal them. Here in the United States, we had a law one time that introduced prohibition, and a few years later, we had a repeal of prohibition. So, law is all pervasive worldwide. Every country in the world has a legislative body. It has policemen and armies, and these armies and policemen enforce these laws, enforce these rules. The law says you can't drive more than a certain speed limit, 50 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour. And if you exceed that speed limit, some guy comes out there, grabs you, puts you in handcuffs, and hauls you off to jail. Takes your car away from you and does all kinds of bad, wicked, terrible, awful things to you. Law is pretty important. Whether you're cognizant of it or not, it's there every day, and it covers and colors everything that you do. When you make a business transaction, you're cognizant of the tax consequences of this transaction. How is this going to affect my taxes? Taxes are regulations imposed by law, rules of the game. Bank accounts, insurance policies, social security accounts, everything is regulated by law. We don't consciously think of it in those terms, but maybe we ought to. Now, when we take a look at the differences between civil and common law, we come to a conclusion. When you go to Blackstone's commentary, there's only two forms of law on planet Earth, civil and common. Now, that's not civil and criminal. Those are two forms of actions. They're just two forms of law. You're either under the common law or you're under the civil law, one or the other. And the common law is very ancient. Very ancient. It's a form of law that goes back about 3,000 years to a fellow named Moses out at Mount Sinai. I'm going to show you that. The Roman civil law is even older than that. It goes back to Hammurabi's code. Hammurabi's code, believe it or not. Old Hammurabi, you know, you probably heard that term from time to time. You might not know much about this guy, Hammurabi, or Hammurapi, as his name is spelled with P's instead of B's, but well, I've always been taught to call him Hammurabi with a B. Well, income tax and Social Security has a connecting link with the common law. And the income tax and Social Security has a connecting link with the civil law. Two forms of law. Let's take a look at the first. Civil law comes from a constitution. All the nations of the world have these founding documents called a constitution. In fact, over in Iraq right now, their interim government is hammering out their new constitution. Under that constitution, their legislature is going to enact statutes. These are laws. These are rules. Then they're going to have a judicial system to impose court decisions based upon those statutes under their constitution, and those courts are going to impose penalties for the violations of those statutes under that constitution. It's the way it works in the United States. It's the way it works in Germany, England, every country in the world. Even North Korea has a constitution and a legislative body. So does Russia and China. And that's kind of funny, isn't it? Because it's all formed and formulated under this process called the Roman civil law. The common law does not work anywhere in the world. It used to. It used to. And the common law still has some force and effect under our Constitution here in the United States. And probably it has some force and legal effect in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, France, the Scandinavian countries and Germany, all of the Western Israelite countries, because this law, the common law, has a common origin. The origin is the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were supported by statutes. Then there were judgments made by Levites and Aaronic priests. Those were the judges. And the ordinances in the scripture, the word ordinance is used, which is synonymous with penalties. We use the word ordinance today with, you know, city and county ordinances as laws. But in reality, an ordinance is a penalty. It's a penalty that you pay for the violation of the law, custom, usage, or practice. So the common law is very ancient, dates from Moses at Mount Sinai. The civil law dates from Hammurabi's code. Now, these are two distinct forms of law on earth, and that's all there is, just civil and common. The common law and the civil law, that's the two forms of law on planet Earth. If you know of another one, send me an email. Let me know what it is, would you? The civil law is bound up in the Constitution, statutes, judgments, and the penalty clause of statutes by license and consent. License and consent. Remember that. You've got a driver's license, marriage license, a plumber's license. I mean, you get a license for everything that you do. Think about it. A license and consent. The common law is very ancient, and it's bound in the Ten Commandments, statutes, judgments, and ordinances, commonly known as the Law of Moses. The common law is predicated upon these three principles. Rights, and it's based upon individual responsibility, inalienable rights, and property. Three basic pillars underlie the common law, and that is individual responsibility, also known as strict liability, inalienable rights, rights that are God-given and can't be taken away, and property. That's a right to use something or the right to the thing itself. Now, the civil law is predicated upon three things also. Three things. The civil law is predicated upon franchise, and it's based upon privileges, limited liability, and equitable interest. Did you get that? The civil law is predicated upon a franchise. A franchise is a privilege. Like the Federal Reserve Bank is a corporation. It's a franchise granted by Congress to a group of bankers. A marriage license is a franchise granted by government to you and your spouse. A driver's license is a franchise granted to you and granted to you to operate a motor vehicle on a public highway. These are franchises. And they're based upon privilege. That's why your driver's license is called a privilege. Limited liability, that's also known as insurance. And equitable interest. That means you don't own this property, but you have an interest in it. And we commonly call that communism, and communism is predicated upon this principle that's from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. That's called an equitable interest. You don't own it, but you have an interest in it. So the common law is based upon land, labor, and substance. The civil law is based upon contract over time for profit and gain. The common law is based upon rights which require a damage to someone's life, liberty, or property to constitute a crime. The civil law is based upon privileges which require acts or omissions upon statutes with penalties to protect the public interest. So these two forms of law are diametrically opposed to one another. One is the right to own property, the other is the antithesis of property rights. It's an equitable interest, share and share alike. I remember as a child, mothers, young mothers used to come out into the sandbox and they would scold their children for being selfish and not sharing their toys. I was raised in one of those old-fashioned kind of homes where we had property rights and my toys were mine. And I didn't have to share my toys with anybody. If I wanted to, I could, and if I didn't want to, I didn't have to. They commonly called little Georgie a selfish pig. A selfish pig. Because little Georgie practiced personal property rights. I raised my children that way also. My wife and I have had 12 between us. Over the years, raised a bunch of grandchildren. And I always upheld that right to property, that even a child 5 years old that has a rag doll, you know, once that rag doll's been given to that child, that rag doll belongs to the child. And it's not for community use. It's kind of like a wife. You know, she's private property and she's not for community use. It's kind of like your car that's yours to drive and nobody else's. Now, if you want to let somebody else play with your rag doll, sleep with your wife, or drive your car, that's your business in life. But under the common law, we have these inalienable property rights. It's a wild new concept here in America. Wild new concept. See, here in America, people don't own automobiles. They go down to the car dealer and they sign a contract over time. They sign a contract over time for profit and gain. And GMAC or Ford Motor Finance owns the automobile. They have an equitable interest in the car. They make payments on the car. They park the car at their home in their driveway in their garage, but they don't own it. They act like it's their car. If you say, whose car is that? They don't say, that's Ford Motor Finance. They say, that's my car. It's not, though. They're actually lying to you, but they honestly believe that it's their car. As long as they're making the payments on it, they see that as their property. There's no property right in a contract. Overtime for profit and gain. You have an equitable interest in it, but you don't own the contract. Ford Motors owns the contract, and they own the car. Now, under the common law, the common law is based upon land, labor, and substance. That's a wild new concept, too. You see, under the law of God, the common law, the Mosaic law, you would go out and claim a piece of land. And that's called real property in today's parlance. You would apply your labor on that land, and you would create substance off of that land, and that substance was your property. So the land is your property, the labor is your property, the substance is your property, and it's inalienable. It belongs to you, you know, like the rag doll. Nobody else can have it. Keep your hands off of my wife. In modern America, we like to share things. We like to have equitable interests, and so we have mortgages on our homes and contracts on our cars, and we have payments that we make on our credit cards. We buy a lot of things. We have a lot of stuff. We drive motorhomes and automobiles and live in nice houses and watch big screen TVs and don't own any of it. We just make payments on it. Isn't that just special? And that's the Roman civil law. That's the antithesis of property and property rights. It's the exact opposite to the Mosaic law and the Ten Commandments. But, you know, Americans have made a choice, and it's the choice that most people in the world have made. Most of the people in the world are in debt, just like we are here in the United States. And the World Bank and various lending institutions loan countries and loan nations and loan businesses and corporations and empires, and they're all in debt. So when we take a look at civil and common law, they are two forms of law. They're very ancient, been around for a long time. They're constantly at loggerheads with one another. The entire world now operates on the Roman civil law. America used to operate on the common law. Under our federal constitution and most of our state constitutions, until they were amended in the aftermath of the Civil War, we practiced the common law. We practiced much of the common law after the Civil War until about 1900. Using, you know, gold and silver coin as an illustration. In the Bible, God told us, "You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag." Our founding fathers created a constitutional provision that says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Those are common law principles and common law statutes and common law laws that we Americans practiced until 1913, when we created the Federal Reserve Bank. And then we had a kind of a mix of the two until 1933, when the civil law under Franklin D. Roosevelt abolished gold. It's against the law to hold gold any longer. Took our gold away. Then in 1964, they took our silver coin away and gave us clad coin. So there's an example. And there are 22 of those examples in our federal constitution. Our federal constitution has 22 principles of this old common law contained in our constitution. Another one is, at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. That's in Deuteronomy 19:15. See, to convict somebody, you have to have two witnesses. Or you have to have a license. You see, the license is the prima facie evidence of your intent to break the law. Because a license, by definition, is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal and lawful, a tort or trespass. So when you have a driver's license, it only takes one person, the policeman, to come in and testify against you. Doesn't take two or more. That's because you have a license. And that's one of the fundamental differences between civil and common law. The common law requires two or three witnesses against you. The common law is different than the civil law in that the civil law requires that you have a license. Common law doesn't require that you have a license. It requires that you be individually and personally responsible for your actions. But you see, with a license, you're not responsible for your actions. Your guardian is. So the civil law works upon a guardian-ward relationship between you and the state. The state is your guardian. You give up your individual responsibility. You do that with insurance. I remember a guy said one time, he asked me, he said, do you have auto insurance? And I said, no. And he said, oh my God, you're financially irresponsible. See, people go to public school and they're taught that. In our state, the compulsory insurance law was enacted in 1976, and it's called the Missouri Financial Responsibility Act. Financial Responsibility Act. Let's test it. Let's think about this for a minute. You're a licensed driver, and of course you have insurance because you are a responsible citizen. So you went out and you put $500 on the counter or $1,000 or something on that order, and you bought this insurance policy. All right, now you're ready. You go out on the road and you're driving down the road, and you run some guy off the road. And you cause this guy a damage. You wreck his car, you put him in the hospital, and you say, but I have insurance. Okay, now who's responsible for payment of these damages? You or the insurance company? Well, the insurance company, of course. Okay, so who's financially responsible? You or the insurance company? Well, it's the insurance company. So you're not responsible for the actions or the damages that you caused because you have limited liability. You paid the premium to the insurance company so that you could limit your liability to the amount of the premium. So your responsibility is limited to the amount of the premium, and once you've had the accident, you call your guardian, the insurance company, and you say, hey, Mr. Insurance Company, come fix this damage. It's $100,000. I paid my $1,000. Now you come out here and pay the other $99. So that's called limited liability. Now, under the common law, we practice what's known as strict liability. And God requires, under the Strict Liability Act in Exodus 28, that you be personally responsible for all these damages. So let's try it this way. I go out and I run you off the road. And I don't have any insurance because I'm responsible for my own actions. And it's $100,000 damage. And I didn't pay my $1,000 premium. Who's responsible? Well, little Georgie Gordon is. Now, most people would say, well, yeah, but you don't have any insurance, so you can't pay. Who said I couldn't pay? What made you think I couldn't pay? Well, what if you don't have $100,000? Okay, well, here's the way the common law works. It's called bond servitude. So they'd take me up before the judge, and I'd say, well, I don't have $100,000, but I run this guy off the road, and under the Strict Liability Act of Exodus 28, I guess it's Exodus 28, I ought to look that up. Sometimes I make citations and get the numbers wrong here. Let's look at Strict Liability, Exodus 21. My right here, Exodus 21, comes to my mind. Verses 28. Nope. That's 22. Yeah. It's Exodus chapter 21, verses 28 through 36. It's also called the law of negligence. So let me correct that. I said it was Exodus 28. It's Exodus chapter 21, verse 28. Verse 28. And there's the example of strict liability. So when strict liability kicks in, under the law of negligence, it calls for an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, wound for wound, stripe for stripe, life for life. And so I ran you off the road. And so what you do is you bore a hole through my ear and sell me to the aggrieved party. That's called bond servitude. And then I work it off. See, I've got labor, and my labor is worth minimum wage, and minimum wage is $5.15 an hour times 2,000 hours in a year. That's $10,300 a year. And so you might take me into bond servitude for 10 years and make me work for you. And if you didn't want me to work for you, you might sell me for $100,000. You know, sell me to somebody else. Now, of course, somebody woke up to that and they said, well, that's kind of bad. You know, that's slavery, and we think that slavery is bad. And I just wanted to point out that this slavery, this bond servitude, came from God. It's a social status created by God. And, of course, God made a terrible mistake when he did that, so we fixed that. Remember? Abraham Lincoln fixed that mistake that God made in that bond servitude. And he created the Emancipation Proclamation, 1863, followed by the 13th Amendment. Isn't that just special? Every time God makes a mistake, thank God we've got a Senate and a House of Representatives and a president like George Bush or Abraham Lincoln comes along and fixes God's mistakes. I just wanted to share with you, the old common law had a system whereby people could pay their debts. And we didn't have any insurance premiums to pay, and we didn't have any insurance industry. And of course, I'm not telling you that you shouldn't have insurance. I mean, if that's what you want to do in life, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But it's the diametric opposite to the common law. It's the diametric opposite of the law of God. It's the Roman civil law. We'll take a closer look at that as we progress. But it's the midway point in today's broadcast, and we're going to have to give you a couple of caveats here and a couple of reminders. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct. It's 417-273-4967. Again, area code 417-273-4967, or click on to the email off of our webpage. It's easy enough to do. Just call us and tell us you'd like a copy of the free General Law CD package. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, tonight we're talking about the common law. Where'd it come from? What is it? Of what value is it? How do you use it? Why should you use it? Most people don't. Most people are just happy as clams at high tide that they don't have to. We used to practice the common law in this country. Remember, we have 22 principles of law that come directly from the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Code. They're engrafted right into our federal constitution. Like it or lump it. Now let's take a look at the common law link by an archaeologist. The guy's name is E. Raymond Capt, C-A-P-T. In chapter 12 of the book Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets, published by Artisan Sales, P.O. Box 1497, Thousand Oaks, California. The zip code is 91360. Copyrighted back in 1985 by Artisan Sales. The Library of Congress catalog card number is 84-72637. The ISBN number is 0-93466-15-6. In case you want to get a copy of Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. Now let's take a look at the origin of this old institution called the common law from an archaeological perspective. Although originally the United States of America was an offspring of Great Britain, from the present standpoint, the United States of America and Britain are brothers, even as were Manasseh and Ephraim, their progenitors. They speak the same language, English. They use the same weights and measures, a system of their own. Their legal systems and constitutions are built upon the same common law, which had its origin in the law of Moses, the law of the Lord. Hence the fame of American and British justice throughout the world. And we should also point out that these laws formed a part of our culture long before the Christian era. These facts give us added proof, forming another link in the chain of evidence connecting us with ancient Israel. Now, the common law began in England as far back as 1100 B.C. Now, that's 1100 before Christ. That's 1100 years before the common era, when it was codified by Brutus of Troy. Brutus was a great-grandson of Aeneas. Aeneas was a descendant of Judah Zerah. The law was again codified by Malmudius about 500 B.C. It was King Alfred the Great who again codified it in 872 A.D. Alfred, the renowned Saxon lawgiver and administrator during the Saxon period, places the divine origin of the law in the forefront, and the following is taken from Alfred the Great, which proclaims the law of Moses as the basis of Anglo-Saxon administration. So whether you live in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, the United States, Anglo-Saxon administration is the basis of your legal system. Now, you have perverted and corrupted it, no doubt. And you've adopted the Roman civil law, and you have thrown out the Ten Commandments and the Bible, of course, from your public schools and public institutions. But as we progress along, you'll see that there are little shards, little pieces, little bits, little nuances of this old common law that are still in operation in your countries to this day. You know, we still practice the bondservant statute in our military services as it relates to enlistment. You can only enlist in the military in this country for 6 years. 6 years. You can't enlist for 2 years. You can't enlist for 20 years. You enlist, and every time you do that, you enlist for 6 years. The seventh year, a Hebrew must be free and unbought. Every seventh year. Isn't that just special? So the following is taken from Alfred the Great, which proclaims the law of Moses as the basis of Anglo-Saxon administration. Coming then to his task with this in view, we find Alfred's Code, or Alfred's Dooms, as they are called, starting with an almost literal transcript of the Decalogue. The only variations of any moment are that the second commandment is omitted from its rightful place and it stands as the tenth. Then immediately after the Ten Commandments come selections from the Mosaic Code, chiefly from the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd chapters of Exodus, very slightly modified. All right, so if you're keeping score here, you got a scorecard out, get your pencil, sharpen it on both ends, and write this down. Exodus chapter 19, verse 16, is where the Old Covenant begins. And in Exodus 24, verse 8, is where it ends. So in Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 24:8 is where you'll find the Old Covenant contract. Now, the word covenant means contract, and all law is predicated upon contract. It's the will and consent of the governed. The will and consent of the governed. All law is predicated upon your consent, both civil and common. Isn't that just special? And that was mandated by God Almighty Himself. It's called the right to choose, and you'll see that in Deuteronomy chapter 30, where He said, I'm going to command you this day to choose, make a choice, as to whether you want to follow me or you want to follow Baal. And so, you cannot be compelled to violate the law of God. And if you refuse, you won't be punished. You'll see a couple of examples of that. A fellow by the name of Daniel. He was a follower of the God of Abraham. He was a practitioner of the Ten Commandments. He was a practitioner of the Mosaic Code. Well, he lived in a place called Babylon. Today we call it Iraq. In those days they called it Babylon. And one day they enacted some new legislation, some Roman civil law legislation, ancient, old-timey, Hammurabi Code-type legislation, and it said that if you worship any other god other than the emperor or the king here, why, you're subject to the death penalty. And so Daniel swung open his windows and prayed to the God of heaven, and sure enough, they arrested him, gave him a trial, and they threw him into the lion's den. Remember that story in Sunday school? Well, he was practicing the common law. He was practicing the law of Moses. He was an iconoclast. He's one of these weirdos, religious kook, and they threw him in the lion's den, and the lions didn't eat him because his God protected him. You want to find out whether or not you're worshiping the God of Abraham, you know, just go into the lion's den, you'll find out. And the lions eat you, you'll know that you got the wrong God. If the lions don't eat you, you know you got the right one. Most people don't want to test it. Daniel, I'm sure, wasn't too excited about testing it either, but he didn't have any choice. They threw him in there anyway. And then they threw his enemies in there, his political enemies, and the lions ate them. Okay, so that's settled. That settled that debate. He had three friends, three cousins, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar threw them into the fiery furnace. They didn't burn up. They came out alive. So there's a couple of examples. And there was Jonah and the great fish. And there's a few other examples in the scripture, but those are some of the more noteworthy. Now, let's take a look here at Exodus chapter 21, verse 1, 2, and 3. Here's the Mosaic Law. And then we'll take a look at Alfred and how Alfred codified that in 872 A.D., a law that we follow to this day. Now, these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go free, unbought, for nothing. Now, if he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she's borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, and I'll not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges, and he shall also bring him to the door, or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Bond servitude, also known as slavery. Now, there's the statute in Exodus chapter 21, verses 1 through 6. Now, in 872 A.D., King Alfred, the King of England, you know, the King of Great Britain, codified that into the English common law. The law of the commoners comes right out of the Bible. Then there's the law of the aristocracy, the king's law. Now, that's the law that we have coming out of our Congress, the king's law. Buckle your seatbelt, things like that. These old concepts of law, grand juries, petite juries, the law tries the jury tries the law as well as the fact, those are principles of law that come from the common law. And some of those principles we still have today, and most of them, of course, we don't. Most of them we have abolished, just like we abolished the Bible and the Ten Commandments from our public schools. I mean, after all, God made a mistake, and so we're out here busily fixing it. But Alfred codified this. Now, Alfred made 49 dooms. He took this law in Exodus 23, or Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, the Old Covenant. He took that law and he codified that into 49 statutes, 49 dooms, as they were called in Old English. And here's doom number 11. He said, these are the dooms that you shall set them. If anyone buys a Christian bondsman, be he a bondsman to him 6 years, the seventh be he free unbought. With such clothes as he went in, with such go he out. If he himself have a wife, go she out with him. If, however, the Lord gave him a wife, be she and her barren the Lord's. If then the bondsman say, I will not go from my Lord, not from my wife, nor from my bairn, not from my goods, let then his Lord bring him to the church door and drill through his ear with an awl to witness that he ever henceforth be a bondsman. So, we used to practice strict liability. today, of course, we looked at that and said, well, we don't like that. We want to practice limited liability. And of course, when you change your law, well, then of course you get benefits and you get results. So you take a look at the benefits and results that we got from the common law, the benefits and results that we get from the civil law, and then you choose, you decide, which would you rather practice. Now, under our Constitution here in the United States, we can practice the common law. We have a right to do that. It's called religious free exercise. It's protected by the First Amendment to our federal Constitution, and every state is subject to that federal Constitution. I know it's a wild new concept, but, you know, mull it over a little bit. Here's the second one. Now we shall see that the obligation of an oath, which had no sanction attached to it apparently by West Saxon law until Alfred's time, is very carefully enforced in the latter part of the code regarding pledges. The Saxons were to return a man's pledged garment before sunset only, if he have but one wherewith to cover himself. Then a slight variation in the dooms occurs in regard to Exodus 23, verses 3 and 6. The following dooms continue an almost literal transcript of the 21st chapter of Exodus, with the exception of the 17th verse, which is omitted. This slight modification of the Hebrew law in the first verse of the 22nd chapter are again characteristic. Let's try Exodus chapter 22. Here's another example of the Mosaic law. If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. And if the thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. Alfred codified it this way. He said, if anyone steal another's ox and slay or sell him, give him 2 for it, and 4 sheep for one. If he have not what he may give, be he himself sold for the fee. Now, this statute here separates misdemeanors from felonies. Misdemeanors and felonies. You see, if anyone steals another's ox, that's a pretty big animal, and slays or sells him, give him 2 oxen for it, 4 sheep for one. If he has not what he may give, be he himself sold for the fee. Whatever the debt is, he has to be sold for it until he works it off. So under old Saxon law, under the Mosaic Code, practicing an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, wound for wound, stripe for stripe, you see, crime was beneficial. Crime was productive. Crime was profitable for the victim. Let's test it. You come over and you steal my car. And you take it out and you part it out and you sell it. And I don't get my car back. It's gone forever. Parts are gone. And you spent the money on drugs and wild women and had a good time. We catch you, and we prosecute you, we convict you. What's the penalty? Well, you have to pay me back 5 cars for that car. So, I had a $10,000 car, and now you got to pay me $50,000, and you don't have any money. So, we bore a hole through your ear and sell you to me until you work off the $50,000. And believe you me, now I've got $50,000 worth of work for you to do. And if you get uppity with me and said, well, I'm not going to work, we'll just take a whip to you and whip you until you do. And now that's not very kind and that's not very gentle, but that's private property and that's property rights, and that's the difference between crime and crime and punishment and punishment. Now today, the way we handle it is this. I come out here and I steal your car, and you lose $10,000. Then they prosecute me and convict me and throw me into prison. Now, it costs $35,000 a year, and I'll be sentenced to 5 years in prison, and I'll serve 1.5 years or 18 months. So it's $35,000, so it's 35 plus 17, 5. Or $52,000. And you, Mr. Sucker, you, Mr. Victim, that lost $10,000 on your car, can now get busy, get your butt out, and go to work, make $52,000, and support me in prison for 18 months. Then, at the end of 18 months, I get out of jail, and I'll be on parole, or supervised release, which only costs half as much. So it's only going to cost $17,000 a year for 3.5 years. 3.5 times $17,000 a year is another $59,500. So get your butt out there, partner, and get to work and support me while I'm on parole and probation, etc. Now, that's the difference between the civil law, which is very kind and compassionate for criminals like me who steal your car, as opposed to the common law, which is very, very harsh on criminals like me that steal your car and make me pay you the whole $50,000. But you see, under the modern civil law rule, the government and lawyers and judges and probation officers and prison guards and construction companies that build prisons all benefit from crime. Under the common law, under the law of Moses, there's only one beneficiary, and that's the victim of the crime. The victim of the crime. You get five times the amount that I stole from you. Now, if I didn't sell your car and you found me with the car, then you get your car back and one more. And if I can't pay, well, I don't have to pay you five because you got your car back. But for the inconvenience and the loss for the time that you lost it, you get one car. So I got to pay you $10,000 instead of $50. I pay you $10. So I only have to work one-fifth as long. Now, let's suppose that I've got this theft bug. Some people have this theft bug. They can't control it. And they go out and they steal once and they get caught and they steal twice and they get caught. Now, some states have this third strike and you're out. Well, that third strike and you're out comes from the old common law. Did you know that? Yeah, that's right. First time, you know, it's 2 to 5 times. The second time, it's 2 to 5 times. The third time, it's you're out. We take you out and stone you to death. You can come up in the resurrection. We'll deal with you then. Yes, sir. So you don't have a lot of repeat crime under the common law. You have some. You have some repeat crime. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, you got jails, you know, and they talk about this thing of repeat offenders. Yeah, got these guys that keep coming back, the revolving door of justice. Well, that's the kinder, gentler Roman civil law for you. The common law isn't too kind and gentle. It's kind and gentle to you the first time. The first time you get caught, you get to pay five times the amount that you stole to the victim. Second time, you get to pay five times that you stole to the victim. And the third time that you get caught, we take you out and stone you to death. And that eliminates crime. It terminates crime forever. Well, terminates the crime from that criminal forever. We won't have that problem anymore. Wild new concept, but just thought I'd share that with you. Now, here's another one. In Exodus 22, verse 3, if the sun be risen upon him, there shall be bloodshed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. And if the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be an ox or an ass or a sheep, he shall restore double. See? Now, here's the way Alfred's Doom worded it. If a thief break into a man's house by night and be there slain, be he not guilty of manslaughter. If he doeth this after sunrise, he's guilty of manslaughter and himself shall die, unless he did it of necessity. That's called self-defense. If with him be found alive what he stole, let him pay for it twofold. I mentioned that to you the other day. There was this Cuban guy down in Florida, and there were some people broke into his garage, and it was pitch black. He didn't know who was breaking in or what they were doing. And he shot and killed one of these kids, or two of them, I forgot now exactly. But they prosecuted him for manslaughter, which is correct under this old common law rules, huh? And the moral to the story is that you don't shoot a thief because the penalty for theft is not death. The penalty for theft is restitution, not death. So there's a couple of three examples of the common law versus the civil law. Then follows verbatim James' epistle from the Jerusalem Council to the church at Antioch, after which Alfred again goes on. Now, get this. Back in the Middle Ages, you know, this is 872 A.D. Now, this is before Magna Carta. These people actually went to the Bible to get their law. Kind of a wild concept, isn't it? Think of it. Then follows in Alfred's Dooms, verbatim, James' epistle from the Jerusalem Council to the church at Antioch, after which Alfred goes on, that you will, that other men do not to you, do you not that to other men. No, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. From this one doom a man may think that he should doom everyone rightly. He need keep no other doom book. Let him take heed that he doom to no man, that he would not that he doom to him, if he sought doom over him. That's kind of old English for, you know, if you're going to do something to somebody else. For instance, down in Texas, there was a guy, he was a black guy, and these two white boys, they thought that this black guy was a sodomite. So they tied him onto the back of their pickup and they drug him to death down the road. Now this black guy didn't get a trial. He didn't get a jury. He didn't get to face, confront, and cross-examine his accusers. And he may well have been a sodomite. And he may have well been worthy of death. But you know, under Anglo-Saxon administration, we don't just practice vigilante law. We don't just go out here and kill people. We don't just drag them to death unless we try them first and convict them, you know, give them a fair trial, give them an opportunity to deny it, give them an opportunity to prove that he's innocent, make you prove that he's guilty. But the moral of the story is that the penalty for these two white boys under the Mosaic law, we would try them and convict them, give them an opportunity to prove that they're innocent, let them face, confront, and cross-examine their accusers, and then after we convicted them, fair and square, we'd tie them on the back of a pickup and drag them to death, right out in public so that everybody could see it, so that everybody could hear, see, and fear. Because this is what we're going to do to you. Because we're going to do unto you that which you did unto him. Now it's bloody, and it's not kind, and it's not gentle, but it's very effective. It's very effective. It really controls crime. It controls crime two ways. First of all, it sends a message to everybody out there, if you do this, here's what we're going to do to you. And if that isn't a deterrent, if that doesn't deter you, then you go ahead and do it, and we'll drag you to death, we'll kill you, and we will eliminate your criminal life, your criminal activities permanently. Now, that's the way the Bible and the old common law controls crime. We just eliminate the criminals. All right, so there's the first part of this story here on the common law. We're out of time, so we'll have to leave it right there. And we'll be back tomorrow night to talk a little more about the common law. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.